Stop a moment and think about your favorite lake. Maybe you like to swim there or take a boat on the water or fish or just sit by the lakeside and enjoy watching the water. When it's there, that is. That is an issue for some of our lakes in this drought. But think about how your favorite lake was created. By glacier? By volcano? By humans with a dam? Those examples just begin the list of ways that lakes are created. We get the full list and a whole lot more information from John Richard Saylor in his book, Lakes, Their Birth, Life, and Death. John Richard Saylor is a mechanical engineer who focuses on the places where water and air interface, things like drops and bubbles and waves. So, of course, that includes lakes. John is a professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University. John Richard Saylor, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff. Glad to be here.
It is a pleasure. That is some second paragraph. Most lakes are born of violence. Do we always know what that kind of violence is?
Very often we do. I also note that more often than not, that violence is the slow motion violence of glaciers. And glaciers are really the master builder of lakes. So on planet Earth, chances are, if you're next to a lake, that lake was formed by some kind of glacial activity. By some estimates, about 90% of the planet's lakes were ultimately formed by a glacier.
Oh, wow. But it did through different processes, as you point out, not just grinding and scraping, but naturally damming and dissolving in some cases.
All kinds of methods. So I guess sort of the classic glacially formed lake, at least as the way I like to think of it, are the Finger Lakes in New York State. So the glacier moved southward from the north and carved out and modified valleys. And when the glacier reached its maximum extent and began to recede, it left a whole large amount of till and moraine behind, which dammed up that valley. And, of course, the glacier itself left copious amounts of water behind, so creating those lakes in the process. So those are often kind of very obvious lakes. You know, they're very striated and long, very long aspect ratio. But, of course, there are also kettle lakes are probably the other very commonly found lakes. They're formed in a more kind of messy, complicated process where the glacier kind of leaves glacial moraine all around, so you have a sort of an isolated, enormous chunk of glacial ice with moraine in it, and as it melts, it forms some kind of dip or other, which creates a lake, along with often a very complicated coastline.
So some of this sounds like calving, you know, the thing we watch on the glaciers as they actually hit salt water, but underneath instead of on the sides.
That's true. So, we like to think of glaciers advancing and receding as sort of a uniform front. But as you point out, just like calving, often a glacier will recede and leave a bigger chunk behind while the rest of the glacier kind of goes away.
When we talk about lakes, though, I come back to our region because the high desert east of our listening area seems to specialize in shallow lakes that are not always there. Are those, in fact, true lakes or really just low areas where water collects?
Well, so there's always that semantic issue when it comes to lakes. What exactly does it have to be in order to be a lake as opposed to a sea or a wetland? So there are lakes that periodically do dry out. Playas are an example of that, of course, and some people refer to playas as lakes and some refer to them as wetlands that are periodically dry out and go away. So you can get into a lot of wrangling over terms, what's a pond, what's a lake. Mm-hmm. So sometimes these questions are a little difficult to answer.
Sure. How critical, though, I mean, in general, are lakes to life as we know it on Earth?
Well, incredibly critical. And if you have any doubt as to how critical lakes are to humans, all you need to do is look at the dams we built and how many of them we build, right? So we human beings are incredibly prolific dam builders from the very big project dams like Lake Mead and things of that nature down to the tiniest little livestock pond formed by a farmer using his backhoe. we have been building dams all over the planet, and we've been doing it for a very long time. Archaeological evidence for the first dams created by humans date back to at least 1,000 years before the time of Christ, if not much farther.
Wow.
Before that, in the Middle East. As soon as we started to settle into places and to grow crops, we realized that it'd be a far better thing to have a body of water nearby us than to not have that body of water nearby us. And so we've been building dams. And we've gotten pretty good at it. I mean, some of the dams in Europe date back to Roman times. So there are dams that are actually still used today in Spain. The Prosperina Dam comes to mind as one that was, I think, built in the first century A.D. By the Romans and still holds back water today. So we are critically dependent on lakes. We're dependent upon them for drinking water, for municipalities. We depend upon them for irrigation. We depend upon them for livestock. So they're just an extremely critical aspect of the water cycle for humans.
The book is divided into birth, life, and death, as we hear in the subtitle. I mean, are all those life cycles going on at the same time? I mean, not on the same lakes, obviously, but all over the earth, we have all those life cycles represented?
So, yes, to a certain degree. Birth is, as I said, typically via glaciers, and of course we're in between glacial periods now. So the formation of lakes via glaciers, although it still occurs, has of course slowed. But yes, there's lakes that are in the midst of their lives, and lakes that are you know, close to the end of their lives. So the death of lakes can occur in a variety of ways, but natural death of a lake, the most common form is a very slow and very simple process called silting in. So a lake has a source of water in the form of a stream, a river, runoff from a bank, and all of those inflows, when they enter the lake, carry sediment with them.
Okay.
So this is a natural process. As the water slows down, as it enters the lake, the silt settles out, and that silting in will ultimately be the demise of the lake.
John, is there a clear dividing line between lakes and ponds?
There is not. So as I write in the book, there's often a little bit of quaint fretting over the difference between what could be called a pond and what could be called a lake. I think that's really true mostly with older textbooks on lakes, limnology textbooks. And more modern textbooks, I don't really think, seek to make a differentiation. In fact, in modern textbooks, when authors try to take on the difficult task of determining exactly how many lakes exist on Earth, it's pretty much a mathematical thing now. So the number of lakes that you will find depends critically on what you call your lower bound, right? So if you call your lower bound lakes that have an area of 10 square kilometers or larger, you're going to get a certain count. And if you reduce that to 1 square kilometer or larger, you'll get a larger count. So I think really the notion of what's the lower bound is, well, whatever you choose, and in particular, whatever you're able to measure.
All right, so let's go into the sections of the book, birth, life, and death. And birth, we talked about glaciation and how about 90% of lakes are created by glaciers. But volcanoes is also in here. Now we're talking about Crater Lake right near us. So are there many similar like it?
There are. In North America, perhaps not so much, but in Japan and in Central America, along the so-called Ring of Fire, where there's significant volcanic activity, there are a lot of crater lakes, and they can even dominate. They can be in that region the dominant form of lakes. There's, of course, we have our Crater Lake here in the U.S. in Oregon, which is a very large lake. And crater lakes can do some interesting things. I talk about one crater lake in particular, Lake Nyos, which exists in Cameroon in equatorial Africa. And this is sort of an example I use to sort of reveal how, you know, we think of lakes as sort of these very pastoral places, often beautiful, a place you might want to vacation or or own a lake home for certain. But some lakes can be kind of violent and dangerous, and Lake Nyos is an example of that. The danger from Lake Nyos wasn't because it's a crater lake. It's located, as most crater lakes are, in long dormant volcanoes.
In the caldera, like Crater Lake?
Correct. In the caldera, like Crater Lake. And in Lake Nyos, the lake is deep, and at its floor are cracks through which carbon dioxide from deeper in the earth bubble upward. And this bubbling upward of carbon dioxide at Lake Nyos had been occurring for quite some time. As these bubbles rise into this deep lake water, they are going to dissolve into the water. And because the water at depth is at a very high pressure, just like in a can of soda, the amount of carbon dioxide that can be dissolved is much larger at that higher pressure. And just like when you open a can of soda and suddenly the carbon dioxide comes out of solution because the pressure has dropped, if you were able to take water from the depths of Lake Nyos, this crater lake, and bring it to the surface, that carbon dioxide will come out of solution as well. And on August 21st of 1986, no one's sure exactly why. Many people think it was due to an underwater landslide. But some of the saturated water from the depth of Lake Nyos moved upward. So when it moved upward, its pressure dropped. The carbon dioxide that was in solution came out of solution in the form of bubbles. Those bubbles rose upward and entrained further deep lake water with them. That entrained water then rose upward as well, and the carbon dioxide came out of solution and formed more bubbles. And this process repeated. So this is a feedback cycle, a cycle of exponential growth. And another word for that is an explosion. So that's exactly what happened. The lake exploded. It's called a limnic explosion. It wasn't, you know, anything to do with lava or anything like that. It was simply an enormous volume of carbon dioxide was released. The estimate is about a quarter of a cubic mile of carbon dioxide was instantly released from the lake and flowed down the side of the mountain that night, killing 1,746 people in their sleep in the towns that lay below, along with livestock and essentially anything that breathes oxygen was killed that night due to this disaster.
Because the oxygen was crowded out by the carbon dioxide?
Correct. In the long term, that was the cause of death. Carbon dioxide is kind of interesting. I mean, any gas that's not oxygen will, of course, suffocate us if it displaces air. Carbon dioxide, when you breathe it in its concentrated form, seems to have a central nervous system effect. So most of the people who were found dead clearly dropped right in their tracks. They passed out immediately.
Wow.
And then, of course, died in the minutes later from suffocation.
I remember, you know, Lake Nyos happened within a year of the time that we moved here. And so I've often wondered if something similar could happen at Crater Lake, and I don't see much concern. So evidently the construction of the lakes is somewhat different.
Well, the critical thing is the availability of carbon dioxide from beneath the lake surface. And areas where there's, you know, any kind of volcanic activity or, you know, even very, very far down can cause that to occur. I don't know this, but I'm guessing people have done profiles of the crater lake depth. I'm sure it's a very well-studied lake. So I think if there was any issue there, that would have been something that people had been aware of for some time. So I doubt it's an issue. But in Cameroon, there's sort of a string of lakes where that's the case. There had been a much smaller disaster at a place called Lake Manoon, I think 3 years prior to the Lake Nyos disaster. And there's several others that have this characteristic. So that can happen in a crater lake. It can happen in other kinds of lakes, too. There's a great deal of concern on the other side of the African continent at a lake called Lake Kivu. And this is a lake beneath which not only carbon dioxide, but also prodigious quantities of methane are found. And along the shores of Lake Kivu, there have been instances of, you know, people just suddenly passing out and dying from inhaling some gas. This has happened in many villages along the shore of the lake. There's been exploration of methane at the bottom of the lake, but there's concern that if there was the kind of event at Lake Kivu, which occurred, the same kind of event at Lake Kivu that occurred at Lake Nyos, this would be just a terrible disaster because there's millions of people who live on the shores of Lake Kivu as opposed to thousands at Lake Nyos.
Oh, boy. We're talking about lakes here on the Jefferson Exchange and some of the ways in which things can go wrong with them. John Richard Saylor is a mechanical engineer at Clemson University. He wrote Lakes, Their Birth, Life, and Death. And you may get into the conversation as well. Ask your questions or share stories about lakes you know. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Chris in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. I'm kind of a limnology geek and love this conversation. And can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, God, you know, Lake Taupo is one of my favorites of caldera lakes. It's a big one. And, Lake Kivu and Nyos. Nyos, you know, I mean, the density of CO2, you know, just makes it run downhill like water. Mm-hmm. And, it's just, I'm just really loving your conversation and, keep going.
Okay, will do. Thanks for that, Chris. And we have an email here as well from either Jan or Jan in, I think in Medford. I was born and raised in Minnesota, the land of 10,000 plus lakes. As kids in summertime, we would spend many days walking to the nearest lake to hang out and swim. What is the status of those lakes? Are they silting in or diminishing with hotter temperatures? Thanks for the question.
Sure. So, I've been to that area of Minnesota as well. In the north, it's a gorgeous area, and all lakes are silting in. So, the kind of terrible thing about lakes is the very thing that allows them to exist, namely they have an inflow into a basin, is the very thing that's going to cause their demise, which is that inflow will have sediment and it will settle in the lake bottom. The good news is that rate of sedimentation is kind of low. I mean, it of course varies. This number varies by a lot, but sort of a rule of thumb is that the sedimentation rate is about a millimeter a year. So, if you have a 20 meter deep lake, it's going to be 20,000 years before there's enough sediment to completely fill it in. So this is a very slow process. Okay. More concern when it comes to lakes is the things that we do to them. So, of course, runoff of nutrients due to human activity can profoundly change the biology of a lake. And more dramatically, the fact that we use lakes for a source of water for irrigation and for municipal use can cause lakes to completely dry out. And in the news lately is been discussion of the whole ecosystem in the Salt Lake City area with the Great Salt Lake, and the fact that lake level is going down rather dramatically. And this occurs because the population of that whole valley there, the Wasauk Front, I believe it's called, is growing. Inflows due to precipitation and snow melt are decreasing, and this causes the lake level to go down. And a real risk due to that is the fact that when these, in the case of salt lakes, when the lake level goes down, you leave these enormous flats behind that are covered in, of course, salt. And you can get, not a lot of vegetation is going to grow on that. You're going to get dust storms kicking that up, and that can cause really significant respiratory problems for the surrounding population. And the reason this should be of a great concern to the population around the Great Salt Lake is that this is precisely what occurred in one of the largest natural disasters ever in the Aral Sea. So the Aral Sea is also a salt lake. It's not actually a sea; it's a lake. And in the '60s, so it exists right in the boundary between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, what was once the Soviet Union. And in the 1960s, the Soviet Union began an irrigation project to grow the agricultural output of that area. And they did a really good job of it, but in the process, they diverted so much water from the river that flows in that the RLC became about 10% the size of its former self. And this was, you know, once, I believe, the fourth largest lake on the planet, and now it's just 10% of that. And what has been left behind are these extraordinary extents of desiccated earth, just salt-laden earth, and also earth laden with pesticides and herbicides from the runoff of the irrigation activity. And dust storms in that area has caused horrible problems for the surrounding populations. It's a true ecological disaster. And it's just something that bears noticing. You know, we look at these enormous bodies of water and think, well, you know, there's not much we can do to you know, make them go away. But in point of fact, we can literally do that. We can dry up lakes by withdrawing so much water, either from the lake itself or from the water sources that flow into the lake.
Yeah, the RLC has always been an interesting case because, you know, we've known about it for so long. And I think I first read articles about it in the 70s or 80s about the fact that the shoreline had receded greatly. And there was some time. I mean, I'm looking at a lake that looks like maybe a half of its original size, well, less than that, and by 1999. So it's not like there was no warning here. There was plenty of time to do something. Why was nothing done to re-divert water back into the RLC?
Well, that's, you know, that's a really good question, Jeff, and I'm not sure there's a simple answer to it. You know, all water resource questions are questions that involve just a very large number of stakeholders, right? So we see this when we talk about any kind of water system in the United States, whether it's the Mississippi River, particularly the lower Mississippi River, the Colorado River, or any water resource, you know, people earn their living on it in various ways. So around the RLC was, you know, at the point in time where you said, well, why didn't they just sort of think about things and change things? By that time, you can just imagine the number of individuals whose livelihood depended on having irrigation water for their farms, right? So if you suddenly turn that off, you've just, you know, put an enormous population of people out of work. At the same time, there's a fishing industry on the RLC. Surely those individuals were pushing for a reduction in irrigation because as water was diverted from the RLC, the salinity progressively went up and killed various species of fish and eliminated the ability of the fishery to work. So it's always, you know, a set of competing interests in terms of these large bodies of water or any water resource in terms of what you want to do with that water.
Well, and then as you point, it seems like the salt lakes in particular get a lot less respect as, you know, they're salty, you know, they don't seem like right. They're as good for people. And so they'll divert the water going into them in a lot of cases. This has certainly happened in Oregon with Lake Abert, where the Chewaucon River is just not getting into the lake. And so the lake is maybe 5% of its original size. But then you point about the same thing going on with the Dead Sea in the Middle East. And it gets really serious when it gets the salinity gets that high. What's going on with halite crystals there?
Right. So, I mean, you're exactly right. So I think we think of salt lakes in a very different way. You know, you can't go to a salt lake and drink that water, right? And so I think it is just more acceptable to divert, you know, fresh water running into the lake. You can kind of imagine it, right? You're living on the shore of a salt lake. You can't drink that water. And at the inlet to the lake of a river or stream, here's this beautiful, pristine fresh water. The logic of diverting that fresh water and using it, drinking it, or irrigating with it is I think difficult to argue against. But yeah, as the RLC pointed out, that there are very, very negative consequences that can occur if we divert that water in a big way. But regarding the Dead Sea, which is also a lake. Yes, it's a hypersaline lake. So its salinity, I believe, is of course going to vary day to day, but I believe now it's about 300 parts per thousand. And to put that in perspective, the ocean has a salinity of about 35 parts per thousand. So it's almost 10 times larger in the Dead Sea. And so the consequence of that, I suppose your listeners have all seen pictures of people reading newspapers and the Dead Sea floating real high because it's just so dense, right? It's so much denser than water that you can just float so easily. But the other consequence is that at that salinity, the water is now saturated, so it simply cannot hold any more salt. So if you either add salt or, as is the case with the Dead Sea, if as water evaporates from it, the salinity will try to increase, but since it's saturated, what happens instead is the salt or the halite crystals begin to precipitate out. And that creates all kinds of really interesting aspects of the lake.
So to finish up the halite in the Dead Sea, so what were you writing in the book, that things that are dipped in the water like ropes form salt crystals on them?
And some cases they just precipitate out naturally. There's videos of what they call salt snow, just the crystals forming right at the surface and falling down. But what you said is exactly right. If you throw a rope into the Dead Sea, come back a few days later, you're going to have perfect, you know, halite crystals form of that rope. You'll also, there's this Israeli artist, Sigalit Landau, who did a number of installations using the Dead Sea. She took a traditional black Hasidic wedding dress and put it under the water surface and took images of it as it slowly turned into a white wedding dress as the salt crystallized upon it. It's really kind of an incredible thing.
Wow, that sounds pretty amazing. I'll have to look for those. So I do want to ask about something relatively close to you, which is the Carolina Bays. They get their own chapter in the book, and I can recommend to people, look up Elizabethtown, North Carolina, which I did, and the site is rather interesting.
Yeah, so the Carolina Bays are probably... You know, there's a lot of reasons I chose to write the book, but the Carolina Bays were probably at the top of the list in terms of intrigue. So, right, if you look up Elizabethtown, North Carolina, just a small town in North Carolina, and look at it on Google Maps in the satellite view, what you'll see is this is one of the density areas where the Carolina Bays are found in highest profusion, and what you'll see there are these beautiful, beautiful ovals, these lakes that are actually perfect ellipses, all with their long dimension, their long axis pointed in the same direction, all pointed toward the northwest. So if you do this exercise, what you're going to see are actually a lot of green ovals because a lot of these lakes have been drained for agricultural purposes, but there are also some that are filled in. And these are found everywhere from southern New Jersey all the way to northern Florida. By some counts, there's as many as 100,000 of them, all perfectly elliptical, and they're just a fascinating... When I first saw them, I was kind of just sort of blown away by it. I just couldn't believe I'd never heard of these things before, and when I began to research them, I was even more perplexed, because although we've known about them for some time, we do not really know how they form. So there's competing theories about the mechanisms by which they form, but none of the theories that we have can completely explain what we see on the ground in these really intriguing lakes. In addition to their shape, a really neat thing about them is that if you read what biologists write about the Carolina Bays, they'll tell you that they're all like their own little almost separate ecosystem, right? So they can be quite close together. But it's almost as if the particularly the smaller species, the amphibians and smaller life forms, kind of evolve right in that place and have no real reason to hop the rim and go to the next Carolina Bay. So they tend to stay there, and they tend to be extraordinarily good locations for amphibians, which is very important because we're losing amphibian species on Earth at a rapid pace. And in the Carolina Bays, they often dry out. Their water source tends to be just precipitation. Not many of them have a stream inlet. And that means they dry out, which is actually good for amphibians because it kills off fish, which are the primary predator of amphibian young. So you get these very, you know, robust ecosystems for amphibians, a very large concentration of the Venus flytrap in the Carolina Bays. And you combine that with their interesting shape, and it's just a really mysterious and wonderful kind of lake form.
It was kind of fun to look at them on a map. It looks like a flock of UFOs because they all have similar shapes and they're all oriented the same way. So it was kind of it's definitely worth looking at for anybody who's interested. And let's take a phone call here from Alan in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Richard Saylor, the author of Lakes.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I just probably have some comments with regard to like a drought and dam collapse, like in the Middle East. For 7,000 years, if you look at the Arabian Peninsula, it opens north, and throughout history, there is this movement of Semitic people, that is the Amorian, the Aramean, the Assyrian, the Chaldean, and the Arabs at the end, to north, and that's due to drought. I worked as a geologist and geophysicist on a place called the Empty Quarter, and there used to be lakes there at one time, but they drowned. Then the last one, which is, I think you probably alluded to it, it's called Sedd Ma'rib or Ma'rib Dam in Yemen, that collapsed and caused a massive movement to north, to Mesopotamia and to Syria and these places. And that happened for 7,000 years. It's been going on and on. For here in this place of the country, we have like the Columbia River. There was about 800 years ago, there was an earthquake that caused a huge slide that dammed the Columbia, created what is called the Bridge of the God today, and created a lake that extended about 100 miles past Arlington. Then eventually the Columbia opened it up. And also, I don't know if you alluded to the Missoula Dam that was Missoula Lake that's created by a huge ice dam that reached us all the way here to Eugene when the flood happened. I've seen like one time a documentary about making a dam in the volcanic area in eastern Oregon, maybe at the turn of the last century, where it created a huge lake, and due to the pressure, eventually of the water, there were probably lava tubes and things underneath it, and most of the volcanic area usually have big fractures, and overnight the whole lake disappeared.
Okay, so that's a good place to pause there. Thanks for the call, Al. I appreciate the level of detail that you brought to this and your own expertise. But so, John, this is actually a major point in human history. Our relationship with lakes is that we make them, we mess with them, and then when something happens to them, sometimes we're forced to move on.
That's true. I have a whole chapter in the book on dams, and as Alan pointed out, you know, I mentioned earlier in the show we've been creating dams for a very long time, and there are consequences of doing that. Some of the consequences positive, some negative. There's always the possibility of dam failures. In the United States, the main consequence of our dam building tends to be that rivers that once flowed into the ocean as a mighty torrent now barely get there at all. The classic example of that, of course, being the Colorado River, which flows into the Bay of California, but doesn't really do that anymore. So we've dammed up that river in many places and withdraw significant quantities of water from it. And as drought has increased in intensity and frequency, we're seeing that these rivers no longer make it to the sea. So the lower stretches of the river often can be desiccated places where they were once the regions of highest flow rate. Dams are also created by nature, so particularly in China, where there's significant seismic activity in areas of mountainous terrain, dams are often formed that create temporary lakes. So it's kind of an awful situation. You have a horrible earthquake with attendant loss of life. There are landslides associated with that, which also causes loss of life. And then behind the landslide, it inevitably falls into a valley where there's a river, a temporary lake fills up. Sometimes they exist for a few days, sometimes for a few weeks, but of course they tend to collapse just when the water is at its largest height, and then you have this sudden dam release and once again a terrible loss of life due to it. So dams have all kinds of consequences, whether we human beings make them or whether they're made by nature itself.
So among the lakes made by nature, Lake Baikal and Lake Tahoe of similar birth processes, why do they appear in the death section of the book?
So Lake Baikal is you know, we Americans love to have our list of number one. It's both the oldest and the deepest lake on planet Earth. Lake Baikal has an enormous volume of water in it. It's slightly larger than the total volume of all five of our great lakes. And both Baikal and Lake Tahoe are tectonically formed, so they exist at the boundaries, or at least where cracks where tectonic activity is occurring, and so they tend to be extremely deep and very 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 large.
How deep is Lake Baikal? I mean, I'm looking at pictures of it here, and it certainly has some resemblance to Tahoe, at least as on the near shore.
Right. I believe Lake Baikal is got a depth of, I think it's over 1,500 meters, so it's actually beyond 1.5 kilometers in depth at its deepest location.
Wow, that is a big lake. Yeah. Also want to ask about a whole other kind of lake when we get to Lake Vostok. Tell people where that is and what it is.
Right. Well, so that's a truly fascinating thing. So Lake Vostok is the example of what are called subglacial lakes. So these are lakes found almost exclusively in Antarctica. And they are lakes that are located beneath the ice cap. So every lake you and I have certainly or probably run into is a lake that's it's got a bottom surface that's dirt or bedrock, and its top surface is an interface between air and water. But subglacial lakes have a bedrock bottom, and their top surface is an ice-water interface. So they are located, in the case of Lake Vostok, beneath over 2 miles of ice. And these aren't little puddles. So Lake Vostok is estimated to be about the same size as Lake Ontario. And there are hundreds of others beneath the ice cap in Antarctica. These are really fascinating places that the community is only just beginning to understand. And what makes them really interesting is that the water in Lake Vostok, as an example, so isolated from the atmosphere, it last was exposed to the air that you and I breathe at least 100,000 years ago, and by some estimates, maybe tens of millions of years ago. So the last time that water in Vostok saw, you know, the atmosphere, you know, it was a time when woolly mammoths were walking around. It was a prehistoric time. Since that time, everything in that lake has evolved completely separately and parallel from us, right? So you and I depend, you know, in one way or another on photosynthesis for everything, right? Whatever we eat, you know, that carbon in the steak or the chicken or whatever it is that we're eating got there via photosynthesis. And in subglacial lakes, 2 miles of ice completely obscures any photon, any bit of sunlight from getting down there. These places are utterly and completely dark. So all life that exists there exists because of chemosynthesis, a very, you know, completely separate way of existence where energy is created not from photons, from light, but rather from breaking down existing chemicals in the water or in the bedrock and using that to release energy and use that to create the biomass of the microscopic organisms that live there. So exactly what those life forms are like is just being sussed out, is just being explored as samples of the water obtained from that. The lake is by no means fully explored, and it's only one of hundreds, so it's just a fascinating future ahead of us in terms of finding out what's going on in those subglacial lakes.
And being careful not to introduce bacteria from above into the water below. So, yeah, it's a really interesting, fascinating process. I can't wait to hear more about that. So maybe that'll be your next visit. John Richard Saylor, the author of Lakes, Their Birth, Life, and Death. John, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Take care.